from Alabama to Ohio, South Dakota to Louisiana, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, calls for using antitrust laws to break up or regulate large tech companies like Facebook or Google continue to mount. But is that good for the consumer? Christopher Koopman from the Center for Growth and Opportunity is here to discuss. President Trump has officially launched his campaign for re-election, and Democrats are set to debate. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. A new lawsuit takes aim at the City of Chicago's aggressive car towing and impoundment policies. Eric Boehm and C.J. Saramella of Reason Magazine have details. And the U.S. Supreme Court has just decided a case with implications for our right to free exercise of religion. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Technology has been one of the fastest growing and most innovative sectors of our economy for decades. But once again, that success is bringing calls to use antitrust laws to place additional regulations on big tech. Christopher Koopman is Senior Director of Strategy and Research at the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. He is here to talk about the impact of antitrust action on consumers. Chris, welcome to American Radio Journal. Chris, we're going to talk about the avalanche of developments when it comes to big tech companies, and we're going to specifically talk a bit about Facebook and Google and some of those platforms that are very familiar to our listeners. But the term antitrust has been kicked around. What does that term mean?
I think the easiest way to understand antitrust is as a broad term for federal or even state laws that regulate business practices or even how businesses are organized and operate, generally to promote competition, ultimately for the benefit of consumers.
Competition, of course, is a good thing. Regulation, however, tends to stifle innovation. Chris, if we look at big tech, if we look at, as I mentioned, Facebook, Google, we look at the spread of the internet, telecommunications, all of this has come about in a relatively unregulated environment. Why now the big push to start regulating all these platforms?
I would back it up just a bit and say that the latest round of the calls for regulating these platforms come in the form of Amazon or Google or Facebook. But this has been part of, let's say, a multi-decade series of calls to regulate tech companies. You can think AOL, AT&T, Comcast, Cox Communications, even the big Microsoft case almost 20 years ago, Verizon, Time Warner, all of these companies have taken their turn as the quote-unquote tech monopolist in need of heavy regulation because of some grave threat to free speech or politics or culture or innovation or competition. It just turns out that Facebook and Google are the companies that are now taking their turn sort of in the spotlight at this point.
As we look back at all those companies that you just listed, and they've all taken their turn as being sort of the bogeyman here when it comes to a monopoly, did any of those fears really ever come to fruition?
And that's a great point about this conversation is with all of those other cases, we have the benefit of hindsight now. So we can look back and take a minute and use that to sort of guide our understanding of what's happening today. And I think the easiest answer to that question is no. None of those major fears came to fruition. And I think there's one great example of this. During the Time Warner AOL merger, there was a big kerfuffle over AOL Instant Messenger, AIM. So for most people, they may either be familiar with the platform because they had AIM, this is the messaging, early messaging platform on the internet, or they had kids or whomever that were using the platform. But almost 20 years ago, this held up a major merger because they thought it was going to be a huge impediment to competition. And there were predictions of imminent tech monopolies as a result of this merger and AIM in particular to come to pass. But looking through the benefit of hindsight, we realized that revamping antitrust regulations to focus on preserving static market conditions, saying just the way things are fine, or we need a sufficient number of competitors, that would inevitably destroy the dynamism that has prevailed for decades and driven the incredible advances in American innovation. I mean, we're talking, this is the most innovative part of our economy right now. And we have multiple committees and agencies at the federal level trying to figure out how they slow that innovation down by breaking up these tech companies.
As we look at this then over the past few weeks, there has been a remarkable number of, I'm tempted to use the term attacks, but challenges to the tech sector. Tell us a little bit about what's happening in Congress as there's activity in both the House and in the Senate.
For anyone who hasn't been paying attention to the almost constant flow of stories coming out of the Beltway, here's just a list of things from the last month. So Democrats in the House are launching an antitrust investigation, specifically looking at these tech companies. Republicans in the Senate have been holding hearings on the way these tech companies have been stifling free speech. The White House launched a tool that it later rescinded for users to report online platforms for political censorship. Elizabeth Warren has more or less built her entire campaign so far for the Democratic nomination on breaking up tech companies. Freshman senator from Missouri, Republican Josh Hawley, doesn't think Elizabeth Warren goes far enough and has gone on the record saying he thinks these companies may not even exist at all if he has his way. The Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission are getting ready to jump in. And it's the closest thing I can find to the D.C. Beltway's best attempt at a battle royale. I mean, you have almost every major player in D.C. and the largest, some of the most innovative companies in the world based in the United States are all being dragged into this major fight over what will ultimately be the future of what the internet looks like in the way the platforms we've all come to know and enjoy will look like in the near future and beyond.
Yet despite all this, Chris, we have a situation where tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of Americans interact with Facebook every day. The term Google has really replaced the term dictionary and even encyclopedias, which I'm not even sure they publish anymore, if you want to find information. So consumers seem to have embraced all this technology. Where do these challenges or threats leave consumers?
That's a great point, because ultimately in conversations about antitrust, the preeminent consideration ought to be on whether or not consumers are made better off or worse off. And in this situation, I mean, you can't find another industry in which billion-dollar companies are willing to give their products away to consumers and give the amount of access, the amount of information, and quite frankly, these amazing tools to consumers free of charge. So the question is really, where does this leave consumers once these companies are broken up, if they are broken up, if all of a sudden they're forced to charge prices? I think it'll ultimately leave consumers who can't pay for these things out in the cold and leave people worse off, which is something you find when you look at the history of big antitrust corporate breakups. I mean, Will Reinhart at the American Action Forum has this great paper he did recently that looks at Standard Oil, American Tobacco, or even the AT&T breakup, the one probably most of us are familiar with from the 1980s. And in hindsight, you look at all of those and you say consumers weren't made better off, and in most instances, they were made worse off. And that is really something that has been lost in this conversation, is how are consumers doing and how will they fare in a world where these companies are reduced to much smaller versions of themselves?
We have been talking with Christopher Koopman, who is Senior Director of Strategy and Research at the Center for Growth and Opportunity, also a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center. So, Chris, tell us a bit about the Center for Growth and Opportunity. And I think our listeners are pretty familiar with Mercatus, but if you could give us websites for those organizations.
The Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University is a university-based research center where we do two things. We have student programs. We have 20 undergraduate and 20 graduate fellows that were getting involved in our research. And then we have a research team that we're digging deep on big questions about the interaction between key institutions, business, government, and civil society, with the goal of providing better data and a clear roadmap to improve opportunity, broad-based economic growth, and individual well-being. You can find anything about the Center for Growth and Opportunity at growthopportunity.org, and likewise for the Mercatus Center, you can find anything about them at mercatus.org.
Christopher Koopman, Chris, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
At the offices of the Club for Growth, we have Scott Parkinson standing by in what has been a very busy political week. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back.
Well, of course, the big news of the week is, to absolutely nobody's surprise, President Trump announced he's going to be running for re-election. He had a big rally in Florida. Interested in your thoughts on the kickoff.
Let's start out by talking about what Florida means to President Trump. First of all, I think it's pretty clear that this is his adopted home state. He has spent more time in Florida than anywhere else in the country aside from D.C., and really enjoys the time that he gets down there in Mar-a-Lago, the people that he gets to take down there and entertain. And this is sort of, you know, his Camp David. He loves Florida. He knows that Florida is critical to his own reelection. And if you actually look back to the 2018 election between Andrew Gillum and my former boss, Ron DeSantis, for the gubernatorial election, the way that that shook out was going to impact the reelection campaign for the president. So I think that the signs are looking really good for him down in Florida, and that's why he chose to make his reelection announcement down there in Orlando.
As we look at the start of this, of course, as usual, the president pulled just an amazing crowd. Polling numbers, though, not looking so good. Do really early polling numbers at this stage of the game mean a whole lot?
Not head-to-head. The issue there is that I think you have 23 or 24 Democrats that are running for the nomination of their party, and then you only have Donald Trump. So if it's Donald Trump against one of the Democrats, usually the numbers are skewed, and it's a lot harder to measure compared to if we have time to build out a narrative and a campaign against a particular nominee. I think that once the Democrats settle on who their nominee is going to be, it's going to be much easier for the voters to focus in on the contrast between President Trump and whoever the Democrat is, and then they'll make their decision. So, look, we can look at the evidence from the last several presidential elections. We know that this is going to be a very, very tight race. And Lohman, your state of Pennsylvania is right there at the top in terms of what's critical for President Trump to win in order to win re-election.
And as we look at this, of course, you've correctly pointed out that head-to-head polling is really skewed and essentially meaningless at this point. But what you can find in polling is you can look to underlying issues and underlying messaging. And the Club for Growth has done just that, taking a deep dive into the Democrat frontrunner. And we'll see what happens after the debates this coming week. But the current frontrunner is Joe Biden. What did your poll show about Joe Biden that our audience might find to be of interest?
That's right. So this week we released a Joe Biden messaging poll, and this tested a number of things about Joe Biden's record to inform the Democrat primary voters and caucus goers in early voting states through Super Tuesday. We conducted this poll from June 10th through the 13th and conducted it with 1,000 likely primary voters. So basically what it showed is when you talk about favorable, unfavorable, Joe Biden leads the pack. He's got 85% total favorability. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, and Buttigieg round out sort of the top tier. But that being said, Biden is the clear front runner. Only 1% of voters have never heard of Joe Biden. I think that even that's probably in the air. I think everybody knows exactly who Joe Biden was and is. So what we did was we tested a number of questions related to Joe Biden's history. And as you go through that, we wanted to make sure that these are messages that Democrats can use. It's not what President Trump is using, and it's how it's going to shape out for the Democrat primary. So it talks about Joe Biden's quotes related to reparations for slavery. It talks about his position on longer mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenders. It talks about his positions on when life begins. Joe Biden has obviously recently flipped on the Hyde Amendment, and he has repeatedly voted to allow states to overturn Roe v. Wade and restrict federal employees' access to reproductive care. So even though like that's not an issue that conservatives would agree with, we're testing Dem primary voters to see when they're educated about Joe Biden and his record, what does that mean for them and how that they shift around. So in the end, Joe Biden is still going to be the front runner even after an informed ballot, but there are some very effective messages against him when it comes to Hispanics, African Americans, ages 18 to 34, women, and you also have sort of the moderate and liberal progressive categories that were tested. What we found was Joe Biden's total support would drop 7% on an informed ballot. So this is up to those Democrats like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, Beto O'Rourke, and Cory Booker, who are really trying to become the alternative to Joe Biden, to use these messaging opportunities to try to claw to the top.
Let's go to the state of Montana. We have only a couple minutes left. We want to talk about the congressional race there. Montana has, what, one at-large congressional seat? Can you tell us what the lay of the land is?
The lay of the land is that Republican Representative Greg Gianforte has decided to run for governor of Montana, creating an open seat in Montana's at-large congressional district. President Trump won Montana by a whopping 20 points against Hillary Clinton, so we think that this is a major opportunity to upgrade the district with someone who actually believes in economic freedom. In our view, Gianforte has been a disappointment in Congress, so we're not really sad to see him leave Washington, D.C. and try to run for governor. We'll see how that shakes out for him. But what we have here is a very, very strong candidate in a guy named Matt Rosendale. Matt Rosendale was the Club for Growth endorsed candidate against Montana Senator John Tester last cycle, and he lost a very close race by less than 16,000 votes. And in February, we did a poll that showed that if Rosendale ran for the House of Representatives, that he would be the favorite by far in doubling his opponents. So we had Rosendale at 48%, Corey Stapleton at 19%, and a couple other candidates at 17 and 10%.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, as always, tell us a little bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization dedicated to economic freedom and economic liberty based in our nation's capital. We have over 250,000 members from all walks of life, including all 50 states in our country. We're united because we believe in this economic freedom. And if your listeners want to join the Club for Growth, they can check us out on our website and join for free at www.clubforgrowth.org. And they can also check us out on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
The city of Chicago is notorious for towing and impounding vehicles. Have they gone too far? Eric Baim and C.J. Saramella of Reason Magazine discuss.
There are few things that are more frustrating than getting your car towed. There's that moment of panic when you can't find it, followed by, if you're anything like me, more than a few moments of rage once you realize exactly what happened. But I don't think any of us have ever gone through a towing experience more rage-inducing than what happened a few years ago to Andrea Santiago. Andrea is a Chicago woman suffering from multiple sclerosis. Her van, including a $10,000 wheelchair lift, was towed by the city and then destroyed. And we're going to talk today about the legal action that she and others are now taking against Chicago's really messed up towing regime. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Baim with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is C.J. Saramella. He's an investigative reporter for Reason Magazine. He's a colleague of mine, and he joins us now on the phone from South Florida. C.J., thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me, Eric.
This whole story about Andrea Santiago just makes me so mad, C.J., but of course it's not just about her. You've been on top of this for a while now, and you've written several pieces for us about Chicago's towing scheme. The most recent one with the headline, Lawsuit Challenges Chicago Towing Racket After City Destroyed Disabled Woman's Van. That's up at Reason.com right now. Our listeners can check it out there. Before we talk about that lawsuit, though, tell me a little bit about this towing without telling policy that Chicago seems to have. They can basically just take your car?
Well, not exactly. I mean, Chicago has a massive towing and impound program. It tows cars for unpaid tickets. It tows cars for a variety of city code violations. It tows cars when they're parked on the supposedly wrong spot during the winter months. It tows cars when they've been quote-unquote abandoned, which is what happened to Andrea Santiago. The city is required when it tows a car to send a notice to the owner saying that, hey, we took your car, you have this amount of time before we dispose of it. In most cases, it sells the car at auction or to the towing company, who then does what they want with it. But a lot of people complain that they never get those notices. And that's what happened to Andrea Santiago. Her van with the wheelchair lift had been parked on the street like it had been for years. She got a notice that it had been reported as abandoned. They left a sticker on the car. Her family moved the car up in space and put a sign on it saying it wasn't abandoned. It had all of its current city stickers and tags. They came back and found that it had been later towed. She never received a written notice, according to her lawsuit. The lawsuit is a class action lawsuit filed last week that says this happens to people all over the city. The city tows thousands of cars a year. The WBZ, local Chicago outlet, did a deep dive into this and found that in 2017, Chicago towed nearly 94,000 cars.
Now, I hate to play devil's advocate on behalf of the city here. Really, I hate it. But I guess it's important to ask whether people like Andrea Santiago, people who have had their cars towed, were they in some way violating the city parking ordinances? And I guess what should the city be doing instead of towing the cars?
The first thing it could have done would be to see that the car was obviously not abandoned and that it was lawfully parked and had all of its current stickers and registration. The second thing I could have done would have been to notice the sign that the family had left with a phone number on it saying that the car wasn't abandoned. I mean, a lot of this just comes down to following up. Most people seem to find themselves caught up in this nonsensical bureaucracy where they can't get any information or rectify their situation. There's another class action lawsuit that was filed earlier this year against Chicago for towing people's cars for municipal code violations, like driving with a suspended license or things like that. But it actually has no innocent owner defense. Like if your child drives your car and commits one of these violations, your car will get impounded and you have to pay thousands of dollars in fees. This even happens to people who are declared innocent in court. And the lawsuit argues that the entire process is so inscrutable and hard to navigate and tilted against people, vehicle owners, that it basically makes it impossible to get their cars back.
We are talking with CJ Saramella. He's an investigative reporter for Reason Magazine, and he's been writing about the really awful situation in Chicago where the city is towing literally thousands of cars every year, sometimes for no good reason at all. CJ, just about a minute left here, but before we let you go, I have to point out at least a big part of this story is how the towing companies are really benefiting from having this close relationship with the city government, one company in particular, right?
Right. There's basically one towing contractor that the city of Chicago goes through. I believe it got like a $60 million contract. And it's kind of a sweetheart deal for the city and the towing contractor. The city offloads its towing costs and the towing contractor gets to basically get these cars at cut rate value. ProPublica Illinois and WBEZ found that the actual value of the cars that the city sold to the towing company was about $22 million in 2017, but they actually only collected $4 million on it. So they're selling these cars and just drastically underpricing them and giving, like, basically handing them to this towing company. It's about as Chicago as you would imagine it is. Let me put it that way.
Yeah. This story is everything that I imagine about how Chicago city government probably works. We are really glad to have you shining some light on this, CJ. You mentioned, of course, some local news outlets covering this as well. ProPublica Illinois is doing great work. Our friends at the Institute for Justice are involved in some of these lawsuits that are going on. So at the very least, this isn't a secret anymore. People are now starting to fight back. That's all good news, but still just really awful, awful stuff here. CJ, thanks for taking some time to join us and talk about it.
Thank you for having me on.
And again, that is CJ Saramella. He's an investigative reporter at Reason Magazine. You can check out his latest piece on the Chicago towing scam this week at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
In a 7-2 decision, the Supreme Court decided a cross at a veterans memorial in Maryland is constitutional. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kangor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College says those who fought to remove the cross are guilty of religious intolerance.
One of the major decisions the Supreme Court has dealt with in the current term is the Bladensburg Cross case. This is the case where secularists are demanding the removal of a large cross that serves as a centerpiece of a veterans memorial in Bladensburg, Maryland. The Peace Cross, as it's called, was erected in 1925 by a local post of the American Legion and Gold Star Mothers in honor of 49 fallen World War I soldiers. Known as the American Legion versus the American Humanist Association, the humanists are arguing that the cross is unconstitutional because it's on government property. Yep, the very fact that the cross is what makes it objectionable and unacceptable on that spot. Replace it with a statue of Barney the Purple Dinosaur if you'd like, but no cross. Secularists appeal to the First Amendment, which says, in part, that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, as if allowing a cross memorial in Bladensburg to continue standing would constitute Congress pursuing a Christian theocracy. Those same forces, however, always selectively invoke that handful of words while carefully avoiding the remainder of what the First Amendment says about religious freedom. What does it say? It says that Congress shall not prohibit the free exercise thereof. And the American Legion and Gold Star Mothers, they exercise their freedom of religion in honor of their fallen brothers and sisters. The secularists, however, could give a rip. They want the cross torn down. And this, of course, is an outrage. It's hostility toward religion, pure and simple. It's also a remarkable example of intolerance. How could any American be so intolerant of the religious beliefs of others? Talk about a lack of respect for diversity, liberals! Even more offensive was the suggestion of the judge who ruled against the cross. During oral arguments in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit in Richmond, Virginia, Judge Stephanie Thacker asked the attorney defending the memorial, get this, quote, "What about my suggestion of chopping the arms off?" Unquote. What? Say that again? Yes, the judge offered a solution. Slice off the horizontal arms from the cross. Yep, remove the arms from the cross. No kidding. For the record, the cross doesn't have a corpus, thus the demolition team wouldn't be sawing off the arms of Jesus. Still, the judge would effectively convert the Christian cross into a pillar. Can you imagine the audacity? Thacker's solution prompts this thought. In the interest of fairness and equality, hey, why stop with crosses? Why not target the horizontal parts of the Star of David? That's a religious symbol, too. Are there any large Stars of David erected on government property that we should now express outrage over? Should we launch a nationwide search to put them on the chopping block? Unfortunately, the star would no longer be a star after it meets the axe, but that seems a minor trifle, eh? And to my beloved Jewish friends, hey, no offense, but it's apparently crucial that we do this. We must ensure that Congress does not impose an establishment of religion. Well, I have a better idea. How about if we all learn to be more respectful of the religious beliefs of others? Liberals, I thought you were all about tolerance. As for me, I'll fight for the religious freedom of every Christian, every Jew, and every Muslim. Every cross, Star of David, church, synagogue, mosque. Liberals, how about you folks? For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President, on Ronald Reagan and John Paul II.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KTOK AM in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, WRNN-FM and WKNB-FM in Warren, Pennsylvania, along with WWNC-AM in Asheville, North Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.